You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, ever heard of the Oshkosh All-Stars or the Minneapolis Lakers? We'll talk about the Midwestern influence on pro basketball. Now, President Joe Biden gave his first State of the Union address last night, coming at a difficult moment in world history.
Six days ago, Russia's Vladimir Putin sought to shake the very foundations of the free world, thinking he could make it bend to his menacing ways. But he badly miscalculated.
Biden talked about isolating Russia and supporting Ukraine, lines that got bipartisan standing ovations. And he talked about his domestic policy agenda, highlighting the toll of rising inflation and calling to improve law enforcement by funding the police. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were there parts of the address that you liked, parts that you weren't a fan of? What did you want to hear more or less about? Did the president talk about policies you care about? And what did you make of the Republican response from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathleen Dolan is Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
As we mentioned there, a big moment in world history. I don't think a couple months ago we would have anticipated that the Russian invasion of Ukraine would play such a central role in the State of the Union address. What did you hear from the president last night on confronting that issue?
Well, I think the president was clear in his resolve that he will join with our European allies and other nations around the world to try to stop Putin from advancing into Ukraine, taking over Ukraine, or advancing beyond that, if that's part of his intention. As you say, it is a difficult time right now in the world, and people are, you know, hearkening back to the roots of the Second World War. And so I think it was pretty clear last night that the President Biden wanted to let the nation know that, you know, we are on what could be a dangerous path and we have to stop it.
The president emphasized unity both among the U.S. and allies and in the American political scene. Did you get that feeling, as we've sometimes seen in State of the Union addresses at difficult times internationally, a show of support, a show of unity from both sides present?
Yes. You know, last night from the members who were in the chamber, most of them were supportive, say most of the Republicans. I mean, you know, obviously we're used to the Democrats wanting to support anything President Biden might say. But the Republicans who were in the chamber last night, you know, largely appeared to be supportive of the things that the president was saying. You know, we do acknowledge that not all members of Congress were in the chamber last night. We do want to acknowledge that the Republican Party is having a little bit of a sort of internal struggle over this because former President Trump just days ago said, you know, what a big fan he is of Vladimir Putin and what he's doing was genius. And his first impeachment, you know, was around his treatment of Ukraine. So there is that tension. But last night we saw, you know, Republican support for President Biden's idea that you have to take on authoritarian dictators.
Moving to domestic issues, the economy, always a big piece of a State of the Union address. President Biden had some things to point toward, the infrastructure bill, and he was just in Wisconsin up in Superior earlier today talking about the infrastructure bill. Good job numbers, but also acknowledging high inflation, the impact that's having on American consumers. That was a big topic of the Republican response as well. What did you make of the way the president tackled those economic issues?
Well, you know, presidents are sort of often in a difficult place around economic issues. And I think that it is not surprising. Human nature, you know, tends to attach to the negative news, particularly given the last 2 years the world has experienced. So I do think that the White House and the Democrats in general have had a little bit of trouble getting the message out about job growth and about the strong jobs numbers that come out month after month. And that most people, you know, when they're paying attention are focused on inflation. So I thought the president, you know, did a good job of what he sort of needed to do, which was to, you know, perhaps trumpet the job reports, but also to acknowledge the inflation and acknowledge the pain that it causes people at, you know, that individual or family level. And then talk a little bit about, you know, his plans to help try to contain inflation, or at least, you know, work with the Fed and the Fed members to try to deal with it.
I want to listen to another part of the speech now. The president is talking about crime, policing, and law enforcement.
We should all agree the answer is not to defund the police. It's to fund the police.
Can you talk about the politics of that sentence? It's gotten a lot of attention.
Sure. You know, so there are a couple of pieces. I think there's a historical piece, and by that I mean, you know, just in the last year or two. And then there's a very contemporary piece. And the historical piece, I think, is that there are perhaps some relatively small group of activists who would take the phrase defund the police at its literal face. I think most people do not support that notion of a complete defunding of police and moving to some alternative, but instead pairing police and safety enforcement with more social services, perhaps taking the burden off the police from performing the kinds of roles that they shouldn't necessarily be doing. And so I think over time that phrase defund the police has gotten a lot of traction, but in a way that doesn't represent where I think the majority of the Democratic Party is. And so what President Biden wanted to do last night, I think, was very clearly, you know, signal that he's in the center on these issues. You know, he knows he's speaking to people who are not just Democrats. And so he wants independent voters. He wants Republican voters, perhaps. He wants everybody to understand that he is not somebody who wants to defund the police, but, as he said, train them, you know, supply them, support them, give them the resources they need to do their jobs. And then he talked a little bit more broadly about some of the other kinds of societal needs we have that can be handled by other professionals in other arenas and not just policing.
Talking to Kathy Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at last night's State of the Union address from President Biden and the Republican response delivered this year by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. Here's a listen to a part of that.
It feels like President Biden and his party have sent us back in time to the late 70s and early 80s, when runaway inflation was hammering families, a violent crime wave was crashing our cities, and the Soviet Army was trying to redraw the world map.
Can you talk about the way that speech from Iowa's governor there tried to set up some of those issues, especially in a midterm election year?
Sure. So, you know, Governor Reynolds was chosen very carefully as somebody to give the Republican response, because I think leaders like Kevin McCarthy in the House and Mitch McConnell in the Senate, they want to put a face on the Republican Party that looks much more like Kim Reynolds than perhaps some other more extreme members of the party. And they want to use this as sort of an opening salvo on the kinds of issues that they will raise between now and the midterm elections, excuse me, in November. So, you know, her attempts to try to draw parallels back to the 1970s certainly ignores the last 2.5 years of world history and the impact of the COVID pandemic on life. But, you know, in politics, we often see broad themes that aren't always, you know, rooted in all sorts of specifics, because, you know, her response was much like the president's, in that, you know, there are big top level issues without a lot of nitty gritty. So, you know, the Republicans will try to play on discontent or concern or anxiety or fear that people have, whether it's about their own personal issues or whether it's about international issues. And that, you know, is the job of the response. The job of the response is to make the case for the other political party.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Madison. Dave, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Dave?
Well, first of all, I'd like to compliment your show. Very well done.
Thanks.
And secondly, I would say it's Groundhog Day. Every State of the Union sounds very similar. One party touts what they've done or what they plan to do. The other party responds with a rebuttal that makes it sound like you live in the worst country in the world. And I guess I would argue, you know, we had a position where in 2016, if you look at the numbers, Bernie would have beat Trump. And Bernie got saboteured by the Democratic Party. And the Republican Party wanted no, absolutely did not want him to run against Trump.
Dave, and thanks for the call. I want to stick with the State of the Union and not go too far back to 2016. But his point, David, making there, Kathy, that these things can be pretty predictable. And my emails I've gotten from both parties, Republicans didn't like the speech, Democrats did. Does this really mean anything?
So first of all, let me just say to Dave, you know, shout out to Dave. There are very few political scientists who would agree with you that the numbers indicate that Bernie would have beaten Trump. Having said that, this is, yeah, I mean, Dave's exactly right that the State of the Union, as I said, you know, a second ago, is about the two parties laying out their positions. You know, I'm sure there were very few Democrats that enjoyed any of President Trump's State of the Union addresses, and Republicans loved them. So they, you know, the Constitution tells us that the president must come before Congress once a year and report on the State of the Union. And they do that. And over time, they have become, you know, bigger and grander and bolder and more media event-like. And then the other party has made a response. And this is the pattern. And this is how the two parties communicate. This is one of the sort of centerpiece items in a year. And we do have a midterm election this year. But in a year, say, you know, next year without elections, I mean, this is one of the big ways that the parties try to get people engaged, to offer them information and to try to sway them.
Dave, thanks for that call. We're talking to Kathy Dolan, political scientist at UW-Milwaukee, with us to talk about what we heard in President Biden's first State of the Union address last night and the Republican response. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you hear? What do you wish you had heard about issues like Russia invading Ukraine, inflation, prescription drug costs, you name it? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about President Biden's State of the Union address last night and the Republican response. Kathy Dolan stays with us from UW-Milwaukee, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen? Do you watch or listen to State of the Union addresses in general, or do you avoid them because you kind of know what they're going to look like? What do you want to see Democrats focus on? What do you want to see Republicans focus on as we head into this midterm election year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy, coming into this, a lot of the political talking heads types looked at this as a chance maybe for President Biden with low-ish approval ratings, worried about Democrats' prospects in this off-year election to try to reset, to set a new course. Did you see that happen? Was it something that was really possible?
Well, I mean, certainly in American politics, anything is possible, right? I will say that to me, it was very clear that the intention was to focus on unity where possible and to sort of track in the center for most of the speech. You know, the kinds of things that he talked about beyond the big ticket items that you have already mentioned that we've chatted about, you know, more money for mental health, more money for fighting the opioid crisis, efforts to protect kids from the harm of social media. There were, you know, a lot of things that I think most people would say, oh, yes, you know, we enjoy those things. That makes sense. So I think it was a clear attempt to make the president's agenda, you know, palatable and sort of centrist, because the Republicans are, you know, always focused on the sort of extreme members of the party. And I also think that, you know, he chose unity over the potential he could have done to kind of poke Republicans on issues, you know. So obviously, Ukraine was the opening, and it was a way to start the speech by having, you know, a moment of unity and standing ovation. But you know, one thing that was completely missing from this speech was January 6th and the, you know, dangers that our country faces from internal forces. Some people today, you know, would have argued that he missed an opportunity to put the Republicans on record, you know, as opposing the efforts to sort of get at the roots of what happened on January 6th. But others would say, you know, he chose not to stick a finger in the eye of the Republicans. They certainly wouldn't have joined in the standing ovations and they would have sat there stone-faced. And so I think when he did kind of, you know, poke across the aisle, it was, hey, you know, why don't you guys confirm my appointments to the Fed? And then he talked about his nomination of Judge Ketanji, Jones Brown, to replace Stephen Breyer, and, you know, talked about her briefly and, you know, let's get her nominated. So it was more of a sort of not jesting, you know, but lighter treatment of the opposition.
Do state of the unions or states of the union, I guess, do we have any record of whether they impact public opinion or change approval ratings or move the needle in any way?
The evidence we have suggests that they don't, that most of them don't do much. And I say most of them because most states of the union addresses are, you know, pretty typical and predictable, you know, as you have suggested. Sometimes they're well watched, sometimes they're not. But I think one of the pieces from the Marquette University Law School's poll that you referred to today, the relatively low number of people who are really focused on either the gubernatorial or senatorial primaries here in Wisconsin, you know, people like us who consume a lot of this media forget that the average person spent last night making dinner and taking a child to a soccer practice or, you know, helping with homework or doing laundry, that, you know, politics isn't always on the top of everyone's minds. And so, you know, we find that people who tuned in last night are people who are already engaged and may or may not already have opinions, but probably have less room to be swayed in one direction or the other.
Talking to Kathy Dolan from UW-Milwaukee about last night's State of the Union address. Still time for your response at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Gary from Iron River emailed, said the speech sounded like part of a campaign. Gary thought it didn't focus enough on the U.S. and that Biden didn't appeal to members of the Republican Party, ultimately sounding out of touch, Gary says. These speeches in an election year are definitely part of a campaign, right, Kathy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they are in some ways campaign speeches. I mean, because, you know, people have to remember that presidents can't do a lot of things unilaterally that they want to do. So if President Biden wants Congress to pass a bill to increase funding for efforts to fight the opioid crisis in this country, he is using the State of the Union to sort of, you know, speak to the public, to put a little pressure on Congress, to ask them to pass legislation to increase that funding. So it does have kind of a campaign feel because he is sort of, you know, campaigning to get Congress to do the kinds of things that he wants done. So I don't think Gary is wrong, but I also don't think that in and of itself is a negative. Lots of Americans tend to find almost anything related to politics as a negative. And those of us who sort of study it for a living, I think, can identify lots of ways in which it is a positive or at least a neutral.
And I wanted to bring up decorum at these things, Kathy. Some years back, we had a Congressman Joe Wilson yelling, "You lie," during President Obama's address. Nancy Pelosi tearing up a copy of Donald Trump's address. And now last night we had a Republican member of Congress heckling President Biden, bringing up the deaths of American service members in Afghanistan in the heckling. But as President Biden was starting to talk about his own son's death, possibly due to exposure to chemicals during his time in the service, what do you make of that outburst in that moment?
Well, you know, there were actually the two. Mm-hmm. Lauren Boebert, a member of the House from Colorado, was the one who decided to sort of chide President Biden about veterans issues as he was about to speak about his late son. And then Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, a member of the House from Georgia, they yelled a few things out about building the wall and keeping out immigrants when the president was talking about immigration policy. So, you know, I mean, I guess I would say that I would be somebody who doesn't think that that looks makes members of the House of Representatives look particularly good. I think, you know, if you chose to be there last night, because all members were not there last night, if you chose to be there, you know, listen and don't make it about yourself. Marjorie Taylor Greene gave her own personal response last night, you know, so members of the House and the Senate always are looking for their own campaign moments and their own sort of attention. And I think both of those women are people from whom that behavior was not surprising.
And just our last minute, Kathy, what are you watching for now as President Biden turns to trying to make some of those priorities last night into actual policy that gets passed in Congress?
So, you know, the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives is large enough that the House will probably be responsive to a number of the legislative initiatives the president will put forward. The 50-50 split in the Senate is obviously going to make things harder, because we have seen for the last year or so that you know, there are even Democrats who aren't interested or necessarily as supportive of passing some of those initiatives. The Supreme Court nomination will also make things more complex because that will take up a lot of time and attention and bandwidth in the Senate, and that is certainly going to become a priority. And so I think the problem that we've seen in the Senate is that it has become a kind of a serial actor. You know, they can't seem to be doing multiple things at a time, that, you know, there tend to be a couple of big things that are taking up a lot of the time in negotiation. And so the Supreme Court nomination is clearly going to be a big deal for the next few months. The Democrats would like to move it through, you know, as quickly as possible, try to get it wrapped up by April.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks, Kathy, for joining us. That was Kathleen Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at the State of the Union Address. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Mike Gallagher, Republican congressman from Wisconsin, talks about Ukraine. That's tomorrow at 7 on the Ideas Network. On last week's edition of Food Friday, we talked about cheese, and now Wisconsin is playing host to the big game of cheese. The World Championship Cheese Contest is going on right now at the Monona Terrace Convention Center in Madison. As reported by our own Diane Bazooka, it's not just about cheese. There are also butter and yogurt competitions. When the whole thing wraps up, we'll most likely bring on Central Time cheese fan and former cheesemonger Dean Knetter for some highlights. The early word is that Wisconsin isn't cleaning up in the individual categories. Lots of second and third place showings, only a couple of firsts. In the meantime, what is your all-time favorite cheese? What do you give a medal to, literally or figuratively? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email centraltime@wpr.org. Cheese news you can use. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a key Wisconsin board rejected one set of standards and approved a looser one for so-called forever chemicals in Wisconsin drinking water. We'll find out what that means for communities around the state. Now, the National Basketball Association celebrated the league's 75th anniversary last month. But hang on, our guest says there's more to the story. The anniversary leaves out a part of professional basketball history. Before there was the NBA, or even before the two leagues that merged to create the NBA, there was the Midwest Basketball Conference. Pro basketball historian Curtis Harris is with us today to uncover the Midwest's rich basketball history. Curtis is an adjunct professor in the Department of History at American University. Curtis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Can you tell us about the early history of this Midwest Basketball Conference? Later eventually merged into the NBA.
Yeah. So, the short version of the story is in 1935, the Midwest Basketball Conference got started. And it was a professional league, but it does sound like a college operation, though, you know, a Midwest basketball conference. So just a couple years later, in 1937, they renamed themselves the National Basketball League. And that league went on for over a decade until 1949, when it merged with the Basketball Association of America to create the National Basketball Association. So as I always say, you do the NBL, National Basketball League, plus the BAA, the Basketball Association of America, you get the NBA, the National Basketball Association. So that's kind of the very short version of the story there.
And you make your case that the NBA with the 75th anniversary is kind of overlooking this key part of professional basketball history in the U.S., centered in the Midwest. Why? Why are they overlooking this?
No one has ever gotten a straight answer from the NBA as to why they don't get the history correct. So they do tether their start to 1946 when that other league, the BAA, got started, and that was an East Coast league. So that was mainly in New York City, Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore. Whereas the NBL, that is a Midwestern league, and it was mostly in smaller cities. So like the Oshkosh All-Stars, that was the most successful team of the NBL. But you also had the Fort Wayne Pistons, which are now the Detroit Pistons. The Minneapolis Lakers, now the Los Angeles Lakers. And several other teams like the, just many other teams I can name, but that suffices. But I suspect it's the fact that the NBL was in generally smaller cities and not the glitzy, the large metro areas on the East Coast. And the NBA would like to be associated with those larger cities with its history.
Yeah, we had an Oshkosh and a Sheboygan team here in Wisconsin.
Yep.
These were pretty popular, you said, especially in Oshkosh. Some of these mid-sized cities did pretty well with these pro teams.
Yeah, the Oshkosh All-Stars are really like the, I think, the banner team for the NBL. They existed, well, they joined in 1937, and they stayed with the NBL through 1949. And if I remember right, my memory's getting a little hazy. If I remember right, they won the NBL title twice in their 12 years of operation. And they had a great center named Leroy Edwards, who was a three-time scoring champion in the NBL. They had some really successful teams in Oshkosh, but unfortunately, they were not able to join the NBA when that league got started. So they were kind of left on the sideline in 1949.
Yeah, a big part of the story you tell is that a lot of those original Midwestern teams in the NBL still survive today in different forms, in different cities. How important, like when we look at the modern NBA, the roster of teams there, how much of that comes out of this NBL?
Yeah, so this is a really important point, and why I think people should know about the NBL is that, you know, it just acknowledges the cities like Oshkosh and Fort Wayne and other Midwestern cities that fostered pro basketball. But these were also really smart operations, and they had the best basketball talent as a league during the 1940s. So when the NBA emerged out of that merger between the two leagues, the best players and the best teams came over from the NBL. So the NBL, they were the league that had George Mikan with the Lakers. Many other guys who listeners might be less familiar with, like Bob Davies with the Rochester Royals. But just they powered the NBA. So like the first six NBA champions were all teams that came from the NBL. And so that just shows you the domination they had over the other league that went into creating the NBA.
Now, pro sports in this era were pretty heavily segregated, basketball no exception.
Yep.
You write that the National Basketball League, it fits and starts, did some desegregating, though they didn't always stick with it. What did we see?
Yeah, so I think this is really important for broader American history, because we like to think of, we had segregation, and then, you know, flip a light switch, then we had integration, whereas it was a lot messier than that, so... the NBL shows that kind of messiness, but it did show nonetheless progress toward desegregation. So the first black player in what becomes the NBL was Hank Williams, and he played for the Buffalo Bison back in 1935. But, you know, during World War II, just love the name. As you might surmise, they were sponsored by Studebaker. Team was majority black, so they had seven black players and five white players. Now it's like the first time in basketball history you had an integrated team that was majority black. And then in 1949 or 1948-49 season, you had the New York Renaissance, a basketball team, a black basketball team that relocated to Dayton, Ohio to play in the NBL. And so they were called the Dayton Renaissance, but that was an all black team playing in an otherwise all white league. And that's the first time you had a, or the only time in really professional basketball history, you had an all black team playing in a league with white players against white teams. So that just showcases kind of the integration going on in the 30s and 40s before people typically think of integration in pro basketball.
And Curtis, I got to ask, when I hear people who are very excited about the history of a pro sport, it's often baseball. You are clearly super excited about tracking the early days of basketball history. What took you there?
Well, you know, I come from a basketball crazy family. So my dad played basketball. My older brother and sister, they both played basketball. So I guess I had to basically get involved with basketball somehow. Like I played too, but yeah, I got into the history side of it because, as you mentioned, baseball particularly really does focus on it and champion its history. Whereas I think professional basketball, which I think the NBA deserves some blame for this, doesn't do a good job of putting out its own story and getting people excited about its history. So I feel it's really important to know about the NBL, the NBA, and these other leagues that helped foster and spread the game. Because it's just really just great stories and people to talk about when you look at professional basketball. You know, baseball doesn't have a monopoly on great sports stories. Basketball should be included when we talk about this stuff.
Curtis, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Curtis Harris is an adjunct professor of history at American University. He joined us for a closer look at pro basketball's history here in the Midwest, including teams in Oshkosh and Sheboygan. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about an app that helps users practice the Hmong language.
In the late 2000s, Apple popularized the phrase, "There's an app for that," highlighting the abundance of apps available for the iPhone. But when Annie Vang of Madison got into app development around the same time, she didn't see programs made in the Hmong language. Producer Hope Kerwin has more on the app she built and the way it's keeping native speakers and beginners connected to the language.
Eau Claire resident Tiffany Moa grew up speaking Hmong with her family, but as she got older, she started to lose some of her vocabulary and found herself struggling to remember words she didn't use frequently.
You know, you go to school, you speak English only. I didn't have any classes where they taught you in Hmong, so my Hmong language wasn't utilized as much as I had wanted to.
Moa was scrolling through Facebook one day when she saw a post about an iPhone app called Hmong Phrases. The app allows users to look up words and common phrases and hear an audio recording of how they're pronounced. Moa says she immediately downloaded it, hoping to test out her memory and her grammar.
When you grow up and you don't really speak fluent Hmong, you kind of create your own little sentences and you just formulate your own way of saying things, and it's not always correct. One that I do remember looking for was, "Can I pay for this?" Even now, like if I were to go shopping at like an Oriental store, I wouldn't know how to formulate this sentence properly.
The Hmong Phrases app was created by fellow Wisconsinite Annie Vang, who it turns out is also Moa's aunt. Vang is an iOS app developer from Madison, and she built the program 11 years ago after taking an app development course at Madison Area Technical College. Vang says she was inspired by advice from her professor, who encouraged her to build something she was passionate about.
Google Translate didn't exist at that time, and the Hmong language definitely was not in Rosetta Stone or any of the other language apps that were out there in the App Store. And so I took it upon myself that, you know, I want people to know who we are, who I am, and I felt that it was important to just, have a presence in the App Store and leave a digital footprint of it.
11 years, constant updates, and one major rewrite later, the app now has over 4,000 downloads. Vang says she's always looking for ways to improve the program, taking feedback directly from users and from her parents, who are her primary beta testers. She says there have been some surprising requests from users about what they'd like to see added. She's been asked for more medical terms and Hmong names from people hoping to use them for babies.
They're interested in, like, how do you say a baby name? What does it mean? How do you pronounce it? And I thought it was kind of cool. So that's a feature that I'm currently building it right now, because we're such an oral language that if if you just read the word, the name, you may not know how to pronounce it.
Beyond learning words and phrases, Feng says the app also allows native Hmong speakers to practice their intonation, an important part of the mostly oral language. She says young Hmong Americans often speak Hmong stiffly or struggle to hit the right tonal marks.
I can hear that a lot in the kids that are growing up that are not speaking it fluently with maybe an elder. Even my nieces and nephews do the same thing, where when they say they're hungry, they're saying it like, it doesn't have the right tone markers. And so you can understand what they're saying, but they may not know that they're saying it more English than Hmong.
This is something that niece and app user Moa says she appreciates about the program. Growing up, Moa says she spoke both English and Hmong to her parents, or sometimes a combination of the two, which she and other speakers call Hmonglish.
My parents knew enough of what I was trying to say that in the spot, because they understood it, they didn't say, oh no, you're saying that wrong. They'll just answer you.
Moa says she's not sure she'll ever fully master the Hmong language, but she's motivated to keep practicing so she can one day pass it on to her children and maintain the connection to her native language.
WPR's Hope Kerwin brought us that story about an app for the Hmong language. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, the policy-setting body for Wisconsin's DNR voted on standards last week for PFAS levels in groundwater, surface water, and drinking water. We'll talk to a water policy expert about what they did and didn't pass and what happens next. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. At its meeting last week, the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board reviewed proposals from the DNR on standards for levels of PFAS in Wisconsin water. PFOS and PFOA are two of the most studied versions of this group, are what are also referred to as forever chemicals, and that they don't break down well in nature or in the human body. And when they build up in the body, they've been shown to lead to different types of cancer, thyroid disease, and fertility issues. David Strifling is director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Happy to be here.
Before we get into this meeting this week, can you talk about what seems like a widening number of communities in Wisconsin having concerns about PFAS chemicals in their drinking water in particular?
Yeah, we're seeing them at any number of sites, cities around the state, and DNR is looking at what I understand to be dozens of sites where there may be contamination associated with PFAS that's been found. And so people are scared. People are nervous. You know, you can hardly think of something more fundamental to life than water. And when that's threatened, it's a raw emotion that I think we're seeing around the state.
And it was an emotional meeting. I want to listen to the chairperson of the town of Peshtigo testifying. Cindy Boyle got rid of her prepared remarks. She said she was just reading other people's points. Let's listen to a little of what she did say.
My blood level's 5 times higher than the national average, people. This isn't a joke. This isn't hyperbolic. It is history. It does matter. And for God's sake, it's needed. We cannot do anything. We are all on drinking wells in the town of Peshtigo. 1/3 of our parcels are impacted. 4,000 people, 1/3 of our parcels are impacted. It continues to migrate. If we don't have state standards, there is nothing that we can do to hold our responsible party accountable to provide us safe drinking water. What does that mean? That means we all go every single day continuing to drink poison.
So what are the responsible parties? Where are these chemicals coming from in our groundwater and our drinking water?
Well, we see them from a lot of different sources. These are just organic compounds that have been used in nonstick coatings and waterproof fabrics and firefighting foams and even food packaging. So they're coming from metal finishers and paint manufacturers. They're leaching out of landfills. They're coming from all sorts of different industrial sources, even medical products. And, you know, the mayor there said that she has a bloodstream level of 5 times the national average. And it's very likely, Rob, if you and I were tested, they'd be in our bloodstream too, as well as pretty much every other human on the planet. They are ubiquitous. They're everywhere.
Let's get into what came out of this meeting now. The DNR had asked for a standard on drinking water. Now, there's a few different categories of water. Let's start with drinking water. The DNR said they wanted to set a maximum recommendation of 20 parts per trillion. The board ended up going with 70 parts per trillion. These are small amounts that we're talking about. What does this all mean?
Right. So you might have expected the board either to say just yes or no to DNR's proposal, but instead it chose a third route at 70 parts per trillion. And in doing so, it was adopting what EPA had established several years ago as what's called a health advisory level. And so that was an unenforceable standard at the federal level, but that's where the board turned to get that number. And you know, a lot of the objection to these rules here, I think, at the state level has been along the lines of, well, we should just wait for EPA to develop federal numbers and then adopt those. The frustration is that EPA has sort of been dragging its heels on this, and a lot of states just aren't waiting for EPA. And that's why I think you saw Governor Evers direct WDNR to develop its own standards. So, you know, that's sort of a mixed bag for DNR on this particular rule. It didn't get what it wanted in terms of 20 parts per trillion, but at least putting some kind of standard in place would allow the agency to move forward with testing and sampling from municipal water utilities. Now, that's not to say the standard is in place yet. You know, we're kind of jumping ahead here, mm-hmm. but the legislature still has to approve all of these rules. So the action by the NRB doesn't mean that the rules immediately go into effect. There's another step that has to take place here.
Yeah, and supposing we end up with rules, whether it's 20 or 70 or whatever the number is, and the legislature approves it, you test a town's water supply, it's over whatever that threshold is, then what? What would happen?
Well, theoretically, the DNR could initiate an enforcement action against that municipality to bring it back into compliance. In reality, the DNR almost never comes down with a, you know, real hard hammer on municipalities. Instead, the DNR would likely work with the municipality to get it back into compliance. I think it's unlikely that DNR would impose some kind of heavy fine on a municipality who is not in compliance, especially given that the rules are so new. This would be more of a chance for the municipality to understand what the levels are in its water supply and get back into compliance with whatever the number eventually falls in at.
The board didn't pass a, as I understand this, a groundwater standard. We've been talking about drinking water. This is groundwater, but I guess if I have a well, I'm kind of interested in what the groundwater is like. What does it mean that they didn't pass a standard there?
Yeah, you've hit on exactly the point. So the drinking water standard is only going to apply to municipal water utilities, public water systems. If you are on a private well, that standard doesn't help you. It doesn't apply to your well. And I think that's why we heard that raw emotion from the mayor of Peshtigo there, because you know their residents are on primarily private water wells. So you know, what this means is there's no established level or rule that the DNR can enforce on for private wells. Now, of course, that has important implications for people who draw their drinking water from those wells. It also means that DNR is hamstrung in its ability to make polluters clean up groundwater that has above that, you know, whatever the number would have been, 20 parts per trillion, I think, of that concentration in groundwater. So it's kind of a multi-pronged issue there, but you're absolutely right that this takes away protection for those who are on private drinking water wells, not on municipal water systems.
A lot of
this one was a big blow to DNR, I would say.
A lot of what we're talking about deals with existing PFAS in ground and drinking water. Has anything changed when it comes to new sources, new pollutants that find their way into these waters?
Well, I think, you know, given this, the growing scientific consensus that these forever chemicals are harmful, they are being phased out. They're not totally prohibited yet. And so you could still see some of it coming in. I think that flow has been lessened, but you're right. A lot of the damage has already been done. So, you know, a place like Tyco and Peshtigo or Marinette, that contamination is historical. And so part of the impetus for these rules was to clean up the damage that's already been done. And, you know, that's what DNR was aiming at, I think, with some of these rules.
And then we have these board recommendations. As you say, they have to be passed by the legislature. I believe the legislature's done for 2022. Does that mean, what's the timeline then for something like this?
Yeah, that's a little bit outside my area of expertise, the legislative calendar, but it's unclear what happens next. You know, we've got to go through a standing committee here and then the joint committee for the review of administrative rules. So it could be the case if the legislature doesn't come back soon enough that these rules could be held up until it does, which could be 2023.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
David Strifling is director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School. We talked with him about the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board's meeting last week where they passed some less restrictive standards for PFAS levels in drinking water that the DNR had proposed. As we heard, there would be a road for those standards to come into effect. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Republican investigation into the 2020 elections is still going on. We'll look at the report presented this week by Michael Gabelman and find out what lawmakers are saying in response. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.